there's a spirit here of that, and my husband's getting to experience that, and people are treating him like a human being that, you know, that he should be treated as. And that's without that baggage that the U.S. has around, specifically around anti-Black racism. It's a freeing experience, you know?
My name is Linda Laurel, and I'm asking you to have the courage to listen with an open mind to all of our voices, because our voices matter. Hi, everybody. It's Linda Laurel, and welcome to another episode of Our Voices Matter podcast. My guest today is an environmental and social justice advocate. She's also an attorney and quite a gifted writer. In fact, it was an article that she wrote on Medium that captured my attention. It gave me chills, and before I could even finish it, I knew that I was going to reach out to her and invite her to be on the podcast. The title of that article on Medium is How Racists Ruined Our Anniversary. We go into detail about the article and the incident that led this woman and her husband to make the decision to leave the United States and live in Mexico. They were fed up being an interracial couple and having to deal with the daily aggressions, micro, macro, and otherwise, that came their way. They'd had it. They are not unlike millions of others who have made the decision to leave this country as well over the last several years. On TikTok, the hashtag moving abroad has close to a couple hundred million views last time I checked. People are looking at the quality of life that they have here in the United States and whether they feel that staying here is worth it given some of the challenges that they are facing. Today's story is an intensely personal one as told by our guest, Elizabeth Silic LaRue. Okay, Elizabeth, it is such a pleasure to get to see your beautiful face and meet you really for the very first time. Welcome to Our Voices Matter podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm really grateful to be here. Thanks for reaching out and, welcoming me to the platform.
Of course, of course. And the reason, of course, that I reached out is because I read your article on Medium that talked about racism that you and your husband, who is Black, have experienced, and how it has led you to the point where you have literally left the United States to live in Mexico because you do not feel welcome here. I am going to read something from your article that really kind of helps set the stage a little bit, that really struck me and was part of the reason that I reached out to you. And this is an article that you wrote about you and your husband trying to peacefully celebrate your first anniversary on a beach in Florida where you were living at the time. And here's something that you wrote. Although I'm often mistaken for Latina and people tend to tell me I appear ethnically ambiguous, my white skin is generally a sort of passport. But together with my husband, it's a different story. I watch them behind my shades as they size us up invariably, sometimes openly hostile, other times determined to behave as if we are invisible, and rarely overeager to be friendly, as if to let us know that our relationship is acceptable. This last one, I feel ashamed to appreciate, disgusted with the need for the safety of their acceptance, at the same time that I'm grateful for a human's inclination to send a message, albeit one we shouldn't need to receive, that we belong. What rarely happens is that they treat us like everyone else. Talk to me about that passage and this piece and why you felt the need to share in such a raw way.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I've never heard my own writing read out loud by someone else before. And it just kind of made me emotional to hear it. Well, I guess I should start with the fact that I was a teenage mother to a daughter who is biracial. Her father was also Black. So my current marriage to my husband, which obviously is new because that was our first wedding anniversary that I wrote about, is not my first experience being in an interracial relationship and, you know, having raised a child who is biracial, Black biracial. Race has always been part of my life. Like, you know, thinking about race, figuring out how to navigate race has always been present since I've been 15 years old. And frankly, before that as well. So I think when that happened, the story underlying the passage that you read, it took me 4 months to write about it. And then it took me a couple more months to publish it. And the reason I chose to share it is because I am in a lot of conversations in sort of anti-racism spaces with people across the racial spectrum that talk about racism, but very rarely is this dynamic explored of interracial relationships and multiracial families. I find in the literature, there are generalizations that occur with respect to what people face when they go outside and when, you know, when people talk about raising children, for example, I often find people making generalizations about, okay, you know, white moms, you need to teach your kids this. For example, you need to teach your kids to about their white privilege, for example, right? And I'm like, okay, I'm a white mom. I wouldn't say that my daughter has white privilege at all. she looks Black. She is Black. I mean, that's what it is by the standards that race, you know, that racial categories have been created in the United States. So like the reason I chose to share this was to try to get through to people that the generalizations that we make about race are not always applicable. And there are people that are falling outside of these categories and falling outside of these generalizations. And we have these experiences and we don't really know what to do. You know, like where there's no guidebook, there's not a lot of productive discourse about how to manage these things. And a lot of it, frankly, is laden with a lot of, resentment and, you know, baggage, right? And so it's unhelpful.
Right.
It's unhelpful to my husband. Yeah. It's unhelpful to me, to my child, to, you know, all of the people, which, yes, percentage-wise, there's not that many. But, you know, increasingly, I think multiracial families are going to be a reality and our stories deserve to be told as well.
Yes. Yes, they do. And you talk about, you know, there's no guidebook for navigating these kinds of experiences, and they're experiences that happen to you probably multiple times every single day. And in this particular case, the story that you talk about when you and your husband were celebrating your first anniversary, you're on a beach in Florida. It's, you know, it was still during COVID, trying to be outside, away from people, just enjoy nature. And so I'm going to let you pick it up from there and give us a snapshot version of what happened with these two people on the beach approaching you and your husband.
Yeah. I mean, long story short, we deliberately went there on a cold day. Well, it was our anniversary and it just so happened to be cold and windy. And so we were like, beach, perfect. There won't be people there because we don't want to deal with people because we know how they treat us, which was, you know, summed up in what you read. So we went there and long story short, there were only two other people on the beach at that time. And they were two white men that I think I'll let you read. Anybody listening can read the story for the examples of the markers that indicated to me that these people might be affiliated with, let's say, the right wing and thereby, you know, obviously judgmental mm-hmm. toward Black people in general, and then interracial relationships even more so. And basically, they came and invaded our space. The entire beach was empty, and they went out of their way to walk up within, frankly, inches of us. Laughing. And when I sort of tried to set a boundary around the space, I guess I would say just microaggression kind of behavior. And they did that. And then they left and walked away. And then we started to walk, and on their way back, they, yelled out another sort of comment. And it was just, it was very clear that they were intending to make us uncomfortable and to mm-hmm. let us know that, they had the upper hand. It was their beach, not ours. Like, that was very clear.
Right.
And then later in the day, we actually tried to go someplace else, and we had someone literally pass our car, look into our window, see us, and then slam on his brakes and stop. He was like on his way out of his house to go someplace, stop and like observe us. And, it was just the type of interaction that it was like, he's probably going to call the cops if we stay here. We were on a residential street where he apparently lived. And it was just very clearly like, you don't belong here. So we left. Mm-hmm. And long story short, it just put a bad taste in our mouth and made us, I'm glad that it happened, because it was one of those catalysts that let us know, like, it's not going to get better for us in the U.S. If anything, it's going to get worse because of the current, dynamics.
Because of the current environment. Yeah. So following those two incidents, what you go on to say in your piece is that, and I'm going to read this again because this is really important. You say, when I tell stories like this to well-meaning liberal white people, they often insist that we should resist, that we should have, in fact, stood our ground, and we should have gone on to, not let that other man, keep us from going to sit on the beach like we wanted to. Now, here's where I'm going to quote you. They don't understand that having the right to something on paper is meaningless when you're Black. They don't understand that my whiteness, when with my husband, may or may not actually exacerbate the disgust and rage of people perpetuating racism. They don't understand that the limits of my white privilege are completely unknowable in these circumstances, that I may come across a cop who defers to me because of it, or who wants to punish us both for crossing the race line. They don't understand that men in veterans hats with Trump bumper stickers and assault life decals don't acknowledge the validity of our rights, and that my entitlement to exist in their spaces only lasts as long as my compliance with their rules. The chief one being that separation is maintained between us and them. I get chills when I, even now, reading that. It so beautifully lays out and explains why you and your husband decided that you cannot exist in this country when you're having to deal with that on a minute by minute, day by day basis. How difficult was it for you to write this particular passage?
I mean, honestly, when I wrote that, I won't say it was difficult to write. It was like, it was when I write from a place of it, like it's ready now, right? It's cooked inside of me. Mm-hmm. It forces mm-hmm. itself out of me. I think it's more difficult for me to reread it and to mm-hmm. hear it
and relive it.
Yeah. And sadly, I will say that, because the where we live now, which we love and we're very grateful and glad that we've relocated, but we do live in an area that is populated by quite a number of white American tourists. And we've actually had an encounter that it's amazing how well that passage encapsulates what went on with an encounter we had last week with a group of white male Christian. And I know they were Christian because they were wearing stuff on their body that, you know, indicated that, tourists here in Cozumel. I have not written about it yet, and I'm going to, and it will be published in my blog, but it's exactly that. It's, you know, you're a white woman, and maybe in other, see, this is the thing, I don't know, right? In other circumstances, and if it was me by myself, or if it was me, certainly if it was me with a white man that I was clearly partnered with, none of these things would have happened, period. Right. At all. And the extent to which I feel empowered or safe, or and safe, when I say safe, I mean also safety for my husband, to resist and push back on this. It's very different than what people assume it is. So the point about well-meaning liberal white people, ironically, on Medium, in the comments, right, to that article, a white woman posted, "You should have stayed where you were." You know, and I'm like, so clearly you didn't read the part where I told you you don't know what you're talking about. Because am I going to create a situation where my husband is at physical risk and potentially, you know, killed by someone like those guys on the beach? Or, I mean, look at, you know, I mean, it happens all the time, right? White men get away with killing black men. They do. And am I going to risk his life in order to prove a point because somebody that doesn't even know me tells me I had an obligation to, you know, assert our rights? Mm-hmm. Like, it's just...
And then, you know, the other thing you do in the article so beautifully is you talk about what's going on in your head in real time. You know, the things you're calculating.
Yeah.
Well, if I do this, you know, you say, okay, I wish I had my phone in my pocket, but I don't have pockets. I gave my phone to my husband, so I can't pull it out and record. Mm-hmm. What if these guys are armed? Mm-hmm. What if they have guns? Mm-hmm. We're clearly not armed. And so if we... we create an even more dangerous situation by resisting or whatever. Exactly. There are all of these calculations that literally are happening, you know, in split seconds because you don't know what's going to happen. Yep. I think this is so important that you are sharing this from your perspective, because, you know, I have conversations with my white friends about white privilege, and some of them just don't get it. They don't understand the concept. They don't understand, you know, they don't like the word privilege. Well, I'm not privileged. You know, we grew up poor. We worked for everything we have. It's not about that. It's not about that.
Not.
You know, it is so not about that. So, okay. And your article does such a great job of talking about this, but I want to get to your husband and the impact of all of this on him. Mm-hmm. You know, I can imagine, and you touch on this a little bit, I can imagine the sense of emasculation, the sense of shame, obvious fear. You know, he's a man, he loves you, he wants to protect you, but knowing that really the best protection in most of those situations is your white skin. And that if he were to actually jump in and try to do something, you could both lose your lives. Talk to me about that and how he's dealing with all of this.
Well, it's interesting because he recently actually, I interviewed him, or we hosted a conversation for our vlog where he talked about the sense of where he said he felt like his risk is actually amplified by being with me. Because
his risk is amplified by being with you.
Because I'm white. you know, where if he was with a Black woman or if he was alone, he might face, you know, racial aggression, but the presence of us together makes us stand out more. And, you know, as you know, white supremacy hinges on racial separation and the dynamic of, you know, a Black man and a white woman specifically is the most unacceptable form, right?
Right.
So it's interesting because I think, unfortunately, our relationship made things harder for him. That's kind of the way that he's seen it. And, you know, as far as being a man and feeling like rather than he's not an aggressive fighting type of person anyway, like that's just not his personality. I am. So what's actually happened in our relationship is I've had to rein myself in. Like in that scenario, if anyone was going to start something, it would have been me. And I've had to say, no, you can't do this because you're putting him in a position that he doesn't want to be in and that I don't want him to be in. But I think from, and I don't want to overly speak for him, but from, you know, our conversations, I think what he worries more about or has worried more about is the police. And you know, not
is what, I'm sorry, say that again, what he's a police,
yeah, the cops in the United States. Yeah. So not necessarily the redneck guy with the truck that is, you know, he's good with like, keep going. And I'm going to make sure I don't get us into a bad situation, but with the police, you really have no control. Right. I mean, they like, and frankly, in the United States, for the most part, the white supremacists and the police are one and the same. And so, I mean, look, something just happened in Florida. I don't know if you saw this news story. Two white men shot at each other in cars over a road rage incident. And they each shot each other's daughters. Okay.
What?
Yeah. It was in Jacksonville, Florida. One family from Georgia, one family from Florida. And they were in a road rage incident. And one of them shot at the other car, shot the man's daughter. The other guy turned around and shot at the other car, shot the other guy's daughter. And the amazing thing, I watched the you know, body cam footage afterwards. The amazing thing is that the police, neither of these men were in handcuffs. The police treated them as if they had had an accident. They were ultimately arrested, but it was as if the police were like, yeah, we totally get how this could happen. Now, you know how that would have gone. Right? So, you know, I think for him.
Yeah. Had they been Black.
Yeah.
Had they been Black.
I think for him, the all-powerful presence of white racist policing in the United States was a lot more anxiety producing. I mean, I remember not long after George Floyd's murder, he and I went out in the car and a cop pulled up next to us. He was driving and he started sweating profusely. And because the cop was looking at us and he started sweating, like he started basically having an anxiety attack and had to pull over and I had to drive. That's how it was in the United States. When we relocated, I drove through Alabama. I'm not the driver in our relationship. He's a better driver. He prefers to drive. I'm fine with that. I've done way too much driving in my life, but I drove through Alabama because he was like, I'm not driving through Alabama, you know? And that was about the cops. So I think, like I said, we still deal with U.S. white racist tourists, but they're not in charge. You know, they're the minority. We have no evidence or indication that if something happened here, that the police here in Mexico, especially here in Yucatan, where the majority of the local population are Mayan, you know, of indigenous descent, that they would be favorable to the white people just because they're white. I don't think that that's the case. We don't feel that that's the case. And that we don't have the police tailing us. I mean, he told me the other day he waved to a cop and smiled, and the cop waved to him and smiled back. Like, that's unheard of in the United States South. So I think that's, you know, that was the most, from what I understand, that was the most burdensome for him was the presence of US cops.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you obviously, you and your husband together made the decision to leave the United States. You researched where you wanted to go. You actually wrote another Medium article kind of about that whole process of what's it like to actually emigrate from the United States to another country, all the stuff that you have to think about and do. And so you're just, I mean, how long have you been in Cozumel now? Not that long.
We've been in Cozumel since October 1st. And it's October 21st today.
Right. Okay. And so generally speaking, you've just shared a couple things, but generally speaking, how are you feeling about your decision to live there?
Wonderful. Wonderful. Really. It's, I don't even know where to start. I mean, just, you know, putting aside any issues in terms of social dynamics and racism and all of that, the cost of living here, you know, is just way, way more reasonable, which enables us to have more flexibility as entrepreneurs, you know, to not feel like we have to hustle so hard to make so much money just to have a roof over our heads. Like that in itself is a huge relief. And then, as I said, like we go outside now, like we were literally, you know, resisting being around people, and we don't do that anymore. You know, we actually go places, and I don't mind going. We had gotten to a point where we only ordered groceries off of Instacart because we didn't want to deal with going to the store and like people. And part of that was COVID related, right? Because we were in Florida and people are in denial. And if you wear a mask, they're going to glare at you and all of that. But out here, you know, most people do wear masks in the supermarket, and, you know, you go and the interesting thing is like now there's a little bit of, sometimes I get a little bit of side eye from local folks because they're like, they're tired of white American tourists, right? And they don't know that I live here. They don't know anything about me, right? So they see me and they're like, another one, you know? And I'm like, that's fine. You know, they're not going to like attack me in the parking lot. As you know, which is the difference, right? In Florida, the hostility is dangerous. Down here, if people look at me with side eye, that's all they're going to do. And then he has experienced like these beautiful instances of people helping him. For example, down here, you have to fill up like a 5-gallon water jug every so often because you can't drink the water, right? So they have these water stations all around town, but nobody tells you how to use them. All the instructions are in Spanish, and he doesn't speak Spanish. I do. So he was like, I'm going to go get water. And I'm like, cool, go get water. He didn't really know how to use the machine. And he said a local guy came up to him who, you know, he didn't ask him for help, but the guy saw him standing there looking at the machine, like not knowing what to do.
Like, what do I do now?
Yeah. And he came up and showed him the whole process. And like, they barely had any words that they could share, right? Because my husband's learning Spanish, but he like graciously helped him. And you know, that's, there's a spirit here of that. And my husband's getting to experience that, and people are treating him like a human being that, you know, he should be treated as. And that's without that baggage that the U.S. has around, specifically around anti-Black racism. It's a freeing experience. You know, we just feel like we can go wherever we want, and it's not a problem.
This episode is brought to you by BMW of West Houston.
Hi, this is Robert Ori, the 7-time NBA champ, also known as Big Shot Bob. BMW of West Houston has provided me and my family with the best service and the best experience for years. BMW has been there for me and my family for years, so much so that it has convinced my wife to switch over from a former brand to BMW, and she loves it. BMW has been the car to drive. It is the ultimate driving experience.
You mentioned the fact that you're both entrepreneurs. So tell our audience a little bit about your educational background and kind of, you know, what you've been doing and how it all intersects.
Sure. So my educational background, my undergraduate degree is actually in women's studies and anthropology. So I was studying that, and I graduated college in 2001. So I was studying sort of like intersectional oppression from then. And I found my like old report cards and looked at some of the courses that I took in undergrad. And it was really interesting because it's all the rage now, right? Back then people were like, what are you talking about? You studied women's studies. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do with that? But yeah, so that was my undergraduate education. And then I went into social work. I worked as a counselor for survivors of domestic violence for a while. And I did a lot of that sort of public service work. And then I went to law school and graduated. I got my JD, and my focus was environmental law. And so my career over the course of the last two decades has sort of been this mesh of environmental conservation, policy work, so a lot of outreach and organizing and designing and, you know, getting policies in place around environmental conservation. And then I sort of, in the last several years, have been able to weave in environmental justice, climate justice.
So such an interesting, varied background, and one that, like you say, the intersectionality of it, because the threads are all, you know, they're all intertwined.
Yes.
And so now that you have emigrated to Mexico, you and your husband, you've started a blog and a vlog. Mm-hmm. And I think I have, well, tell us the name of it. I've got it here in my notes.
Yeah.
Waves and Wi-Fi, yeah. Seeking Peace Through Emigration.
Correct.
So tell us about that and what you're hoping to accomplish with it.
Yeah. So we're both creators. I'm a writer. I've been a writer all my life. And only since I was unemployed and like working for myself, have I been able to be the actual face of my writing. And my husband has been doing video editing and media production, sound design, all of that for the last 10 plus years as well. Sort of as a freelance thing on the side. So he left his job in February because they were forcing him back into the office and it was a toxic environment. So he decided to go full-time with his business. So our vlog is, again, Waves and Wi-Fi, Seeking Peace Through Emigration. It's tying together all of these different motivations for our emigration. So racism and the dynamics of being an interracial couple are very much centered in the blog, but then it's also instructive. So, you know, the article that you read about our emigration process and like what we've learned about it, that's going to be a big component of it too. So, you know, telling people the things that they can expect to deal with in emigrating, because it's not all flowers and roses. It's hard. It's a lot of work and it takes a lot of patience and resources and all of that. So kind of talking about that. And then part of it is just like exhibiting our joy, right? Like, you know, we actually made this one public, but we filmed some iguanas doing iguana things in our back yard. Like, you know, our commentary, like we're funny,
yeah,
right?
Whatever iguanas like, do, right?
Yeah, like we joke around, you know, we're very silly and we have a lot of fun. So capturing that as well. And really, I think the goal is to, show people there's a better way of living. And not all people, because, you know, some people are living wonderfully in the United States, good for them. But like people that are subject to this toxic, hellacious environment of the United States that don't feel like they have any other options. Part of it is to kind of give them a sense that, you know, there might be a better way. There might be an out for them. Part of it is to, you know, kind of walk people through that, like help hold their hand through the process and give them tips and tricks. Then part of it is just kind of like a creative outlet for us that doesn't have any parameters around it, right? Because I do client work, but my client contracts are specific to what my clients need. This is just like for us to say what we want to say and do what we want to do, which is,
this is the fun stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is for you to be, I mean, same with me. That's what this podcast is for me. You know, my client work is very specific, but this podcast is my way of engaging the journalist in me and just wanting to share stories like yours and talk about subjects that we don't always talk about and be able to go deep and not just on the surface.
Yeah.
So I love what you're doing. And, you know, we, of course, you know, you got to send me links to everything you want our audience to know about what you're doing. So we'll include all of that in the show notes, of course. And, I just urge, you know, people who are watching and listening to find you on Medium, you know, follow what you're doing. You have such a strong voice. And I think the stories and the messaging that you're sharing are truly important pieces of the conversation that we need to amplify. So I really, really appreciate you making the time to share with us on this podcast, especially literally 3 weeks into a move. You're probably still surrounded by boxes.
Well, you know, what's funny is we only brought what we could fit in our car because it was so expensive. It's very expensive to ship things internationally. So yes, but no, we're tired. But I did want to, I know there's like the switch it up thing. I don't know if we have time for that.
I was just going to say, it's time for us to switch it up. So you have the mic now. You get to ask me whatever you want.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big question, but it's one that is really like the most pertinent question on my mind with any new person that I meet. Which is like, what do you think is the major, this is with the presumption that we know there's something wrong with our global human society right now, right? Like we know there's something wrong. Mm-hmm. So what do you think is the fundamental shift that needs to occur to make things better? Mm-hmm. Like if there's one fundamental element that's at the root of all of these systemic problems, what do you think is that shift that needs to occur?
I love that question. And it's the question that I asked myself before I started this podcast, three years ago. I think there are multiple things that need to happen, but I think the root of all of it is the lack of human connection and understanding and acceptance of each other as humans who have a right to exist. Mm. Mm. I think that we live in our silos, we live in our own little echo chambers, and because of the development of technology and the shift in media and media consumption, we now can get our own points of view constantly reinforced to the point where we don't ever hear or see anyone outside of our own narrow little circle, if that's what we choose. Mm-hmm. But when we take the time to get to know someone or hear someone who doesn't look like us or think like us or pray like us or vote like us, we do find, if we are open to it, that there are some commonalities there. There are some threads of humanity that we all share. Mm. And if we can find that, then we can start to understand and respect each other as the humans that we are. I mean, we literally all have a right to exist and be here just as we are created. I'm not better than you. You're not better than me. My skin color does not make me a lesser human being. These are all social constructs that we have created and codified throughout every institution in our society. But at the core of all of it is the fact that we're all human beings and we need to learn and understand how to connect with each other and accept each other just as we are, because we have the right to be here. Mm. That's what I think.
That is so evolved. It's so evolved. No, it is. I hope I can get to where I can do that. You know,
well,
because some of the trauma makes you like.
I hear you. Yeah. I hear you. And it's hard. It's not easy, especially when you've been traumatized, mm-hmm. especially when you walk through life every day wondering, you know, where the next micro or macro aggression is coming from, mm-hmm. and whether, you know, you have the bandwidth and the restraint to deal with it in a way that's going to allow you to literally exist at the end of it.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a lot of burden. It's a lot. Mm-hmm. It's a lot. But you know, I have to believe and hold on to my faith that there are more people who are like us in the sense that we value all humanity. Mm-hmm. I think there are more of us than there are of them. But, mm-hmm. you know, they're the loudest voices in the room right now. Mm-hmm. And if we stop talking and if we, you know, don't engage and try to change things, then they will have won and nothing will change.
Yeah.
And we will have lost literally our humanity you can take that in multiple ways. Mm-hmm. And I mean it in all of those ways.
Yeah.
We will have lost our humanity. So I refuse to give up.
That's awesome.
So I'm going to keep trying. Yeah. I'm going to keep trying. And you know, we can all do our own little part every day, you know, in small ways, mm-hmm. and large, mm-hmm. you know, pick one that works for you and just be kind, listen, you know, try to understand. I know I think that, you know, when we come across situations where people are obviously seeking to do us harm and that sort of thing, that's not the time for that right. sort of understanding. Those guys on the beach, that wasn't the time for you to engage with them and try to change them. Okay. But my hope would be that at some point there's someone in those men's lives who understands humanity and that you and your husband have the right to love each other and to exist and take a walk on the beach mm-hmm. without being harassed mm-hmm. and intimidated and made to feel like you don't belong. Mm-hmm. My goal is to reach somebody in those guys' circles of being, mm-hmm. change that person's mind, mm-hmm. and then have them talk to mm-hmm. them and say, look, you know, what you just did was just despicable.
Yeah.
What is up with that? Stop it.
Yeah.
Leave those people alone.
Yeah.
You know, it's the people closest to them who are the ones that are going to be able to get through to them, but they have to understand and then have the courage mm-hmm. to have that conversation.
That's a really
so
good
there's
point.
So many layers to all of it. There's so many layers to all of it, but it's not your job and it's not my job. It's not my job as a Black person
yeah.
to educate and make white people feel better.
Yeah, no.
Okay. And it wasn't your job to educate those two men who were intimidating you in the moment.
Yeah. yeah.
But there is still work to be done. It has to be targeted
yeah.
and it has to be ongoing.
A domino, sort of a domino. And I need a few dominoes between me and him.
Yes.
yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. What a great question. And thank you for asking it.
Yeah.
I have really, really enjoyed this conversation. I knew I would. I mean, from the moment I started reading your article, I was like, oh my God, this woman has got to be on the podcast. Please let her say yes when I reach out to her. And I am so glad that you did. Elizabeth Cilic LaRue, you are a wonderful human being. And I thank you for sharing your time with our audience today.
No, thank you. I appreciate all of your encouragement and praise and this exposure. And, you know, I appreciate I just appreciate that you understand what I wrote. you know, and that it resonates and that it makes sense to you. Like that, sometimes, like you said about human connection, sometimes it's just about like, oh, you get it. Like that is, that's a hugely valuable thing. And it's one of the main reasons I write is for other people to say, oh, she gets it. I'm not alone, you know? And
exactly.
So, yeah, I love exactly. it. And thank you for having me. And I can't wait to see the end product. And my blog is on Patreon. Our blog and blog is on Patreon. And it's Waves Great. And Wi-Fi, Seeking Peace Through Immigration. And I will send you the links for all of that. And yeah, sign Wonderful. Up and thank you for your support.
You've got it. Always wishing you the best. Thanks so much, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
I'm really looking forward to following along with Elizabeth's journey, the journey that she and her husband have embarked upon. Having emigrated from the United States to Cozumel, Mexico, we, of course, as I said, will link to their blog and vlog and all of the things that Elizabeth and her husband are up to. Thank you so much for giving her permission to speak and for having the courage to listen with an open mind. We so appreciate you being a part of the Our Voices Matter podcast audience. If you've not already subscribed, please do so and leave us a review on iTunes if you're enjoying the content that we create for you. It's truly a passion. Thanks again, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Thanks again to our sponsor, BMW of West Houston. There's a special offer for members of the Our Voices Matter podcast community. Just click the link in the show notes, bmwwest.com.